for a position on the WBAI local station board. I am currently chair of the WBAI Community Advisory Board, and I have been a WBAI CAB member since about 2012. My financial support for WBAI goes back to the early 1980s, and more financial support is what WBAI needs now. Strategies need to be developed to increase listeners, and WBAI needs to turn listeners into members who financially support the station. This is Neil Voss, and please vote for me.
Hi, I am Guy Vantreska, a candidate for the local station board of WBAI, a native New Yorker, originally from Brooklyn, currently living in Manhattan. I work as a natural health consultant. I've been a student of history most of my life, from ancient times to today. During the Cold War, I served as a U.S. Army officer in Germany, then spent 20 years in the IT industry, most of it supporting federal government agencies. My personal experience has shown me how humans organize their structures of wealth and power. One way to keep those power structures accountable is through media, the fourth estate. I would like to see WBAI return to its investigative journalism roots and to report the voices that are ignored by corporate-owned mass media. Please support me in this endeavor. Thank you.
Hi, this is Joan DiLorenzo, and I'm running for a seat on WBAI's local station board to save BAI and keep it from being shut down. We need free speech, community radio more than ever now, with street news and more programming that reflects the diversity of the community. I'm asking everyone, young and older, let's all work together to bring in new ideas that will better serve the people and the station. Financial transparency is very critical. Email me your thoughts at JONIE7DL@gmail.com. This is Joan DiLorenzo, and why I'm running for a seat on WBAI's local station board. Please vote for me. Thank you.
And please, if you are a WBAI member and you have received an invitation to vote in the LSB elections, it is critically important that you do so, because we have to make quorum. We need more people to send their ballots in. Otherwise, we'll have to extend the election and cost us a whole lot of money. So please look for your emails with reminders every Tuesday from Pacifica.org, and vote now if you're a member of WBAI. It's 8:03. You're tuned to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. Up next, Basiram Chowie, Education at the Crossroads.
Yeah, please. Barizagioni, good evening. Welcome once again to Education at the Crossroads. My name is Basir Mjawi, and we are here this evening, Thursday, as we normally are. And what we're going to be doing is, well, we're going to do a number of things. The first thing we're going to do, and the thing we're going to be doing most of the days, we're going to be talking about a new book, which is just out, called Illmatic Consequences, The Clapback to Opponents of Critical Race Theory. And we have with us right now the editors of the book, and they are Walter Grayson, Professor Walter Grayson, and also Professor Damian Darrell Jerry. And well, we're going to spend most of our time here talking about this work, which I think is pretty important. Also, of course, we have a whole lot of things we could talk about. As has been said by a number of poets and others, we need more time. And I think Education at the Crossroads needs some more time. I also have to be around in order to go ahead and do the show sometime, because I've been traveling a bit and will continue to be doing so. But there's just so many things that we need to cover, whether we talk about the disasters in Morocco and Libya, which are interesting and need to be understood in global political terms, whether we talk about the issues that are taking place here, of course, in the United States. There's just so much we would like to cover. And, well, as I said, we're going to need more time. But my guest here, we want to talk about their book, which is comprehensive and important. And it does something which I think is pretty interesting. We are now at the 50th anniversary of hip hop. Many of you, most of you have probably heard in some way, shape or form that it is the 50th anniversary. In August of 1973, DJ Kool Herc was at a party with, I think it was his sister, actually. Mm-hmm. They were like over in University Avenue in the Bronx, and he started doing something, which, of course, he had probably learned since he had come from the Caribbean, because there was a whole tradition in the Caribbean of folks getting on the microphone and toasting and doing various things. So he did that, and, well, that has become known as the birth of hip hop. So here we are. 2023, 50 years later, there have been a lot of activity. But in this particular book, Illmatic Consequences, we have, well, some scholarly and intellectual activity to go along with this 50th anniversary. And I think that's critically important, because that's one of the issues I guess I have sometimes with hip hop, in that it does not necessarily fulfill the intellectual needs of our community. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to talk about that. It is the 50th anniversary. How do you folks see the importance of this particular celebration that's been going on now for quite a while? Professor Walter Grayson, let's start with you, and then we'll go with Professor Damian Darrell Jerry.
Thanks so much, man. It's so good to be here with you on the show tonight. And I know BAI is constantly carrying the torch for our community, keeping us on the front edge. So thank you for the chance to be here with you. The book, and really hip hop in the way it's evolved, this celebration this year has made me reflect on my life. I was born the week after Herc's party. So basically I've been alive since hip hop was born, and it just tracks so much of my life. So by the time I was 5 or 6, I was listening to Sugar Hill Gang. By the time I was 10, it was all about the real Roxanne and Full Force and UTFO. And just my life tracks very specifically with the way that hip hop grew. And so for this to be the 50th year celebration, it's time for my 50th birthday. I'm still kind of blown away at the way the world has changed from the mid and late 1970s to where we're at in the 2020s. And for the good and for the bad, but at the heart of it is the way hip hop has reflected all kinds of human experience all around the world.
Mm-hmm. Professor Damian Darrell Jerry. Go ahead.
All right. Yes, sir. Well, I actually got the chance to go to the South Bronx for the 50th anniversary of hip hop. I think it was like August 12th. KRS-One threw a free show in the Bronx, so I got the chance to go, and it was an amazing experience. There were all kinds of MCs and DJs and singers, and there were people from the community performing, but there were also, like, you know, nationwide acts like Public Enemy, CL Smooth, KRS-One closed it out. There were representatives from the community, like the governing body, like there was city councilmen there. The representative for the South Bronx was there. Also, Benjamin Crump came out and spoke to the people, and that left a big impression on me. Benjamin Crump on the stage, he said hip hop is Black history. He said that in these times where in the educational system where they are trying to erase and rewrite Black history, he said it is up to the rappers to sort of like take our history forward for those that want to step up to that challenge. And rap has already done that in the past with rappers like KRS-One, Public Enemy, and all of that. So I was really impressed by that. And another thing I was impressed by was the fact that I was at this concert in the Bronx, behind Sedgwick and Cedar. Like, so I was like right there. And it was just the way the community came together to make that happen. I mean, there were policemen like out everywhere, right? There were police everywhere. And the police were actually like, they were grooving to the music like everybody else. And that also left a big impression on me, because I was like, wow, I was like, this is the type of relationship that our communities need to have with law enforcement, with them actually being a part of the community and making people in the community feel protected, you know, instead of attacked. Also, one last thing, the people in the community, like the little houses, like right next to the event, they were vending. So the people in the community were actually able to make money off of the event. Like, people were like on their front lawn selling things. So it's just the way the hip hop brought the community together for that event that left a big impression on me. So and I think that ties into the importance of what hip hop can do and has done these past 50 years.
Now, you use Nasty Nas, Nasir Jones as the framework for your book. How did that come about? Why did you pick Nas as opposed to picking Public Enemy or picking KRS-One, as you said, or someone else?
Well, we were talking about critical race theory, and we said that a couple of things. We wanted to do a book that would reach as many people as possible and would speak a language that could bring that could make critical race theory understandable to, like, pretty much anyone, right? And we felt like one of the problems up to this point is the fact that the term critical race theory had been co-opted, misappropriated. So we wanted to make sure that we brought understanding for the term, but we also wanted to make sure that we reached as many people as possible. Now, excuse me, one of the tenets of critical race theory, the academic discipline, is the idea of first person storytelling, narratives, right? The idea that says, okay, well, in order to learn about a people, you need to speak to those people, right? Those people need to tell their own stories. And we felt as though Nas's album, Illmatic, was like really one of the greatest examples of first person storytelling narratives, and especially using the first person to describe the plights of African Americans, you know, in impoverished communities. So it's like the album is so vivid, and the things that he talks about, it really relates, in my opinion, to anyone, anywhere, right, experiencing hardship. So that's the main reason that we, you know, chose to use not only Nas, but that particular album, Illmatic, as like the framework.
Yeah, the element of storytelling that really grows out of Derek Bell's work and the entire project of actually advancing civil and human rights in the late 70s and early 80s, changing the framework of how we judge how law can be legitimate. That's the project that we stand in that tradition. It's the same project that exists with academic Black studies, is that it's got to be grounded in the personal insight, in the lived experience of people. And so for me, this manifested when our contributing artist, Stacey Robinson, actually was on a Nasir Jones fellowship up at Harvard University. And while he was there, he did a series of portraits of Nas based on the lyrics that appeared on the Illmatic album. And so he had done the art, and that ended up becoming one of the key chapters in the book at the heart of the sequence about how do we actually respond to the deception, to the manipulation, to the gaslighting, to the way that white supremacy attempts to deceive not just Black people, not just people of color around the world, but even deceives people who see themselves as white. And so Stacey's art breaks through that. Nas's album breaks through that. And it sets up a kind of coherent fusion between the intellectual and the artistic, so that there's a vibe, there's this experience, there's this energy that comes out of the book and reading the chapters that's very much like listening to an album, but at the same time, it's actually rewriting your sense, your way of looking at the world, your perspective, and enabling people to grow and find new answers given the attacks that we're currently suffering.
Mm-hmm. Before we go on, let me let everybody know, people who are listening at WBAI.org, you can actually see us if you go to Facebook and go to Education at the Crossroads. Education at the Crossroads, the name of the show. You can actually see us here, myself and my two guests, Professors Grayson and Daryl Jerry. One of the things that I think is critically important is for people to understand what critical race theory actually is. And after we talk about its definition, we need to talk about what happened in regards to the distortion. But you lay out in the book very clearly what critical race theory is, where it comes from. So I'd like you to talk about that a little bit.
You want to jump first, Daniel?
Oh, yeah, sure, I can. So first, when we're talking about critical race theory, when we're talking about critical race theory, we're talking about an academic discipline and pretty much a legal discipline created from the work of Derek Bell, a term coined by Kimberly Crenshaw. And critical race theory, actually, it relates to the way that Black people interact with the law, the way that the law itself not only can define Blackness, but the way and the ways in which the law kind of perpetuates white supremacy. The instances where we see white supremacy inherent in not only law, but policy making in general. And we can, trace this back to all the way back to the Constitution, right? That said people were supposed to get people were promised life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Laws that were totally unequal in their administration, but actually laws that were meant to subjugate African Americans. So today, how does the law continue to subjugate us? That's kind of, in my opinion, that's kind of like the seed of what critical race theory is.
Mm-hmm. Walter, why don't you?
Yeah. So this piece of what Bell and his students, folks like Kimberly Crenshaw, who originates intersectionality, they give us a way of looking at the law through the lens, not just of what their opponents have framed as originalism, this idea that you must go back to the time of when the language in the Constitution was drafted. But you have to actually look at impact. You actually have to expand on the work fundamentally of the jurisprudence that came from Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP in winning the Brown decision and setting the framework that created the civil rights laws in 1964, 1965, and 1968. Critical race theory was designed to examine institutional racism, structural racism, in a way that it was not just about an individual's discriminatory or prejudicial acts, but it's about the things that appear to be colorblind that end up producing disparate results, that produce inequalities that are more difficult to dismantle. And so a lot of the work that emerged out of the late 70s and 80s started actually looking at policy of how local and state government and national government maintained barriers that penalized specifically African Americans, but also any people, Native Americans, immigrants, women. There became a way to see the way injustice adapts and the way that it actually becomes intractable and more difficult to uproot. And those are the methods that Bell dedicated his life to. And one of the great points Danian emphasizes is that Bell was also an Afrofuturist. Like, he imagined the world in his book, Faces at the Bottom of the Well, and the story Space Traders, that there was this way of seeing that just fighting individual bias was never going to undo the structural hatred, the ultimate kind of root of white supremacy. And so by using literature and law together in the context of the emergence of hip hop, it set the table perfectly for us to take on what critical race theory actually is, but then also the way it was being distorted, the way it was being manipulated, starting in like 2020, 2021, to try and energize a real fascist movement that has international implications and connections. And that's why the book was so important, so urgent to get it out and get it in the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you mentioned, in terms of what happened, the first time we see anything in regards to negative interpretation of critical race theory is when Christopher Rufo sends a tweet over Instagram, which is picked up by Donald, who I always refer to him as the chump, because he definitely is not the Trump, he's the chump, for a lot of different reasons, which, of course, we can objectively talk about. You know, I'm not being subjective in calling him a chump. I have to be clear about that. So anyway, Christopher Rufo does this. It's picked up. He becomes a senior fellow in the Manhattan Institute. Now, the Manhattan Institute was founded by the former CIA director, William Casey, in 1978. And since that particular time, talk about illmatic, they've been illing ever since in so many different kinds of ways. Police, education, economics, you name it, they are there trying to just muck up everything. It is very serious. So Rufo goes ahead and he begins as an unknown, but he is picked up by the Manhattan Institute and they provide him with a megaphone to actually go ahead and amplify the kinds of nonsense which he has gone ahead and put out since that particular time. So what started out as an individual tweet on X, which it is now, right, or Twitter at the time, it is now amplified and it's become a national, the anti-CRT movement, the anti-Black thought, the anti-Black history movement has become a national movement on the part of Republicans, white supremacists, racists, you name it. They are there going ahead and just misrepresenting everything. That's where, of course, I understand the motivation in terms of going ahead and doing this book. Talk about the various pieces within the book, because there are a number of them. They are somewhat comprehensive. They are also quite different in regards to their approaches. Talk about what you did, since you folks are the editors, in regards to putting this particular work together.
I'll jump up on that. There's three sections. There's the crisis, which is very intentionally a reference to the magazine published by the NAACP through the first half of the 20th century, still published to this day, that there's an assessment. We need to understand the context of why this attack has happened. And so that's what we do in the first section, is provide the context, accurate definitions of critical race theory, and then a theoretical framework for understanding the importance of the work, why we have to engage in serious study, research, scholarship, and then dialogue and community action. That's all the first section, that it echoes back to the generations of the Black freedom struggle. The second section is essentially the clapback, is when we're talking about the honest depiction of what Rufo and his acolytes have done, the damage that is happening in Florida with Ron DeSantis, and then in Virginia with Glenn Youngkin, and in Arkansas and Texas, and in so many communities across the United States where teachers feel like they're under assault. Black families feel like they're under assault, and not just feel it, like we see in Jacksonville. You know, there are white nationalists going out and killing people at whim, and there's no action forthcoming from these governors to protect Black communities, to protect Black children. And so this is the way we have to start to stand up and document the work that's been happening on this kind of radical fringe to try and destroy the civil rights infrastructure and to subordinate Black people, to take us back in time, not to 1975, not to 1955. These people want to put us back in 1850, where no access to jobs, little access to housing, denial of any kind of education that takes our contributions seriously. So the clapback section goes in and lays out not just the misrepresentation, but also the core of the ideals of white nationalism and how to tear it down. So then the final section is essentially the consequences, the illmatic consequences, as we frame it, that it's automatic that we're going to overcome, that we will triumph in the end, that no matter what setback may come in our direction, whether it's through art or through music or through politics, through our economic strategies, our progress over centuries is inexorable. We're not going to be stopped from achieving the goals that protect our families, that build our communities. And we're at a moment when we can finally crush the white nationalist wing that has been exposed in the last several years. And that's what I really hope people get away from this book in the next couple months, because we have turned the tide. We're seeing reporting that people who are running as MAGA candidates, running as Proud Boy candidates in school districts, they're losing almost three quarters of the elections that they run for. And so the idea is now out. People are taking these ideas and this work seriously. And so the illmatic consequence is really already underway. And we just want to make sure it has the deepest possible impact so that we don't have to go through another cycle of this, like we did in the late 60s and 70s after the King assassination, that we don't have to go another backlash like we saw after Reconstruction across the South in the 19th century. This is our chance to put a final end and achieve a massive victory.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say, and as far as like content, the book is made up of a very diverse base of contributors. We have legal professionals like Professor Lee Ross and Andre L. Smith. We have medical professionals like Ryan J. Pettaway, who juxtaposes the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, with police brutality against Black people as a pandemic of sorts. And he compares those, and he also uses poetry to bring that comparison together. As Walter mentioned earlier, there is a visual essay by Stacey Robinson in the middle of the book that is just fantastic. Another piece, we have Ben P. Levy. has a piece called Rizomatic, which is one of my favorites. It's about collective memory and using collective memory in the classroom to engage students, right? And I really love that. And also we have Lion Man's Project, which that one is from Michael B. Dondo, and he chronicles his work with artists John J. Jennings and David Brom, who went into public schools and taught Afrofuturism, taught speculative writing to students in order to get the students to think outside of the box and be creative with ways that they could change the world and change their neighborhoods. So I feel as though it's not, well, I know that there is something in this book for pretty much every reader, from the hardcore academics to people who like cultural writing to people who want to engage with like more like grassroots activism.
Hey, we'd like to remind everyone you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. We are streaming at WBAI.org, and we are streaming video on Facebook at Education at the Crossroads. If you go to Facebook and put in Education at the Crossroads, the name of the show, you can actually go ahead and see us. And of course, you can tell your friends because it'll be up there for a long time. You know, I've got programs that are up there. They've been up there for a while. So I guess we have to say that Facebook still has some value. Right now, we want to listen to some Nas. It was difficult. I was, you know, looking at the Illmatic album and I'm saying, what can I play where the FCC won't come down on WBAI and I won't get suspended? But I found, first of all, one of the songs, which is pretty clean in and of itself, It Ain't Hard to Tell. And then I see I got a supposedly a radio safe version of that. So let's see what happens. All right, we're going to hear some Nas, and then we'll be back with the editors of this important book, Illmatic Consequences, the Clapback to Opponents of Critical Race Theory. But let's hear some Nas.
Track clientele. My mic check is life or death. Breathing a sniper's breath. I exhale the yellow smoke of the roof through righteous steps. Deep like the shining. Sparkle like a diamond. Sneakers on the island. And my army jacket lining. Hit the earth like a comet. Invasion. Nazis like the Afrocentric Asian. Half man, half amazing. Cause in my physical, I can't express through song. Delete stress like Motrin. Then extend strong. I drink my wet with Medusa. Give a gosh guns in hell. From the trip that I lived in hell. It ain't hard to tell. Salute up, parties are shoot up, Nas are analyzed, drop a jewel, inhale from the at school of full well, you feel it like grill, it ain't hard to tell, I kick a skill like Shaquille, holds a bill, vocabulary spills, I'm ill, plasmatic, I freak beat, slam it like Iron Sheik, jam like a heck with correct techniques, so analyze me, surprise me, but can't magnetize me, scanning while you're planning ways to sabotage me, I leave a froze like all right on in your nose, Nas a rock well, it ain't hard to tell. Frame of mind is chosen.
I leave your brain stimulated. Zinging is frozen, speak with criminal slang. Begin like a violin, end like Neviathan. Is deep, well let me try again. Wisdom be leaking out my grateful truth. I dominate break loose, giving Mike's ministry cycles. Streets disciple, I rock beats this mega trifle. And groove even smoother than moves by Villanova. You're still a soldier, I'm like Sly Stone and Cobra. Packing like a Rasa in OC Ubot. Vocals are squeezed, out some CZs drop, though they need not to sneak. My poetry's deep, I never fail. Nas's rap should be locked in a cell. It ain't hard to tell.
Right, Nas from the Illmatic album. And I said I had to do some work in regards to finding between versions of some of the work there, which, you know, is interesting enough. You know, one of my criticisms from way back in 2009, we were doing a series of debates, and we were calling them the Great Debates in Harlem. These were sponsored by CIMOTAP and Dr. James McIntosh and Sister Betty Dobson. And we were in Harlem. We were in a large church. People would come out. It was actually, interestingly enough, we were using it as a fundraiser for a political prisoner, Dr. Matulu Shakur, who's now an ancestor. Unfortunately, our brother has joined the ancestors not that long ago. But I was one of the debates that we had is, hip-hop good for Black people, yes or no? And it was interesting because at the time I argued no, and I did so for a number of reasons, which I'm not going to go ahead and get into now. But of course, one of the issues was in regards to the language. You know, one of the things we see if you go out to the hip-hop events, you know, I was telling you before, I've been out to a couple of 50th anniversary celebrations. Everybody knows all the lyrics. So they know all the words, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And one of the unfortunate things is sometimes in regards to when young people, when children go ahead and get those words, they begin to use those words in ways which they should not. You know, ways which when I was growing up, we didn't do, we couldn't do. You know, we were in deep check. You know, our parents and the community had us in deep check. And things that we hear now, young people saying in front of elders, in front of anybody without any respect, in part comes from this particular genre, I believe. Right. But hey, you know, that's me. I had some other arguments as well, which I'm not going to get into now. But I think the thing is, and I think this is the issue, because I said, you know, we're not talking about, was hip hop good for Black people, or can hip hop be good for Black people? The question was, is at that time hip hop good for Black people? And I think that one of the issues that we're faced with is that because of the commercial nature of the recording industry, that we find ourselves in a deep, deep bind where we've got record companies going ahead and even changing the kinds of things that people would do, the things that they would create. You know, we look at somebody like Tupac, and, you know, Tupac wanting to present himself as a thug, that was an act. You know, we know, you know, some of us know the brother, you know, we know him, we know his family, we know his mother, of course, we know his stepfather. And, you know, when he went out to Cali and, you know, got with Death Row or whatever else it is, I mean, part of what he was doing was an act, you know, it wasn't real. But, you know, I guess that's another story for another day in regards to the manufacturing of thugism, materialism, some of the other things that we have to really look at and say, you know, is this good? In the meantime, you know we have artists who are positive, who are not promoted in the same way that folks who are, and again, sometimes they may not even be negative, but I mean, the thing that we see now is just the crass materialism, the individualism, you know, which I think is somewhat problematic. And I think that, you know, we have to address. But, you know, back to your work. I don't want to go and talk too much about that.
No, you're all right on it. You're right on it. You're not off topic.
No, I'm not off topic, but I don't want to spend I don't want to spend time there. I want to go and get into the book a little more. Daniel, one of the things that you did, one of the chapters, you had an opportunity to go ahead and talk with Harry Allen. Yes. Harry Allen, who was the media assassin, who was part of Public Enemy. Talk about that particular experience and some of the things in regards to your interaction with Harry Allen.
Well, first of all, it was a pleasure and an honor to sit down and speak with Harry Allen. He was very poignant in everything he said, and he spoke with great clarity and just everything, and not only clarity, but he was really, really good at citing history. And like he talked about the history of Public Enemy, the history of Chuck D, how Chuck D became a conscious rapper. And I was very glad to share that with readers. In the middle of the interview, Harry Allen traces responses to Black progressive, to the progress that Black people have made over the years. And he starts with the critical race theory, or the opponents of critical race theory, but he goes all the way back to the opponents of 40 acres, Black people receiving 40 acres and being compensated after slavery. So that interview, that was one of my favorite chapters in the book, and is very informative, and it's very informative, like on a historical level. I think that particular chapter for me does a really, really great job of just tracing the history of racist pushback from America against Black people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the other things, and you've mentioned it, that you take up is you take up what people are referring to as Afrofuturism.
Yes.
And the idea of Black speculative fiction and other things. I find it's interesting on a number of different levels. I know when I was teaching literature and was looking at speculative fiction, I would start with the works of Amos Tutuola, the Yoruba, the Nigerian, who goes ahead and has things like Palm Wine Drink It and Feather Woman of the Jungle and other works, which are really, really, I mean, they're fantastic in regards to, I mean, the vision that this particular author had. Also, you know, one of the things I would use is Sundiata, An Epic of Old Mali, which is a story told by a griot, which is seriously speculative in regards to the things. And again, you know, it's interesting because there's the question in terms of magic, and what both of these authors talk about is magic. This goes back a long way. It's speculative, but I think it impacts what people should be thinking about in regards to the future. So when we talk about Octavia Butler, when we talk about Black Panther at this particular point, when we talk about Wakanda, I mean, these are all things that are intimately connected. Talk about Afrofuturism and how you see it in, I guess, the context of this book.
You want me to jump on that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. Go. So, yeah, very much like hip hop. Before the word Afrofuturism was invented, I was exploring, looking for it, waiting to discover a phrase that would grapple with it. And so as I've become a professional, I look back over 100 years where, if you look back at 1920, people didn't believe in Black history. You had to have artists and writers argue for decades and provide book after book. Carter Woodson and Du Bois, Ida Wells Barnett, Zora Neale Hurston, stacking up, just making proof that there is a past, that there was a reality. The idea of the epic of Sundiata, like, people were not talking about that story 100 years ago. And like, this was something that we had to excavate and bring to the fore so that we could make use of it today. And so in the 1960s, you began to see things like people criticizing science fiction in the European context and saying for not just Octavia Butler, but Samuel Delaney, where are we going to open the door to show other people's futures? And this takes 30 years before the word Afrofuturism comes into existence. And so for me, Afrofuturism grows out of Black studies. It grows out of this effort to reframe the world of knowledge. Hip hop is a part of that transition. You have artists like Outkast and Missy Elliott and Busta Rhymes that are really doing derivative work from what Sun Ra did. And so this effort to reinvent and use surrealism, I teach a ton about Earth, Wind, and Fire and the way that the visuals that go with their performances let people imagine a different way of being in this world. And this just goes and spreads throughout the 70s and 80s and lets us get to the place where by 2005, even earlier, really, when I talk about Sheree Renee Thomas and Dark Matter, that book opens the door and then sets the table for all of us to bring what had formerly been kind of Black science fiction, different kinds of futuristic art and fashion and style. All of that then emerges in the Black Lives Matter moment, and people begin to popularize the term of Afrofuturism, most notably led by Yatasha Womack and Rinaldo Anderson, both dear colleagues. And so that moment, now coming up, it'll be its 10th anniversary in another 2 years. But that moment, out of the killings of Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown, people are saying we can construct and actually build Black futures in a way that people did not think was possible. And so my particular approach to this has a lot to do with sustainability, confronting climate change, creating new forms of architecture, new kinds of technologies that actually do not produce new forms of cancers and toxic bacteria that threaten our lives. So it's a lot about the kind of ways that we imagine the reinvention of civilization. And at the core of it, it's about restoring what we knew prior to European contact. It's restoring indigenous African practices. It's restoring indigenous practices of the Americas, things that people did not take seriously that actually are vital now for us to protect our world. And so that's to me is what Afrofuturism opens the door for us. It builds on the project of Black studies and Black history, but it actually projects us forward to restoring a past that we never should have lost.
For sure. One of the connections I always make is the connection between Sun Ra and Earth, Wind, and Fire and Parliament Funkadelic.
Yes, sir.
I think it's important to go ahead and do that. And, you know, of course, I've had the opportunity to see all, and, you know, starting back, first time I saw Sun Ra was 1966. I was in high school. So we've got a long history. Ahmed Abdullah, the trumpet player, has a book about his life with his experience with Sun Ra. And that's an important piece. Just out. We've talked about it before. We need to talk about it again. I need to have Ahmed back on the program. But now, in our last minutes, how do we use hip hop as a weapon to oppose this negativity that we're facing?
Well, there's a couple of ways. One way is to use hip hop as a vehicle, right, for information, to get away from the corporate nature of it, and to really, really seek out the grassroots artists, like our son, who has a verse in our book, to really seek out the artists who are really putting out positive music and who are really using the music and the art form and the culture to uplift. I would also say hip hop in itself gives us a grassroots model that we can use for organization. Citing the concert that I spoke about earlier, where it was a neighborhood thing And it took the whole neighborhood to come together in order to make it work. I would also say on an educational level, teachers have great success using hip hop within the classroom, within their lesson plans in some fashion. If it's just giving a hip hop version of a play to students or relaying some history to students through hip hop, or, which I like this even better, actually getting students to write and create music themselves in order to express themselves and talk about the world around them. So I think that, you know, in terms of the future of hip hop, I think it's wide open in terms of the ways that it can be used to, you know, uplift young people, but like the community in general.
All right. And Walter.
For me, hip hop is the way I breathe, like literally the way I speak. So when I go back and I think about learning the lyrics that you mentioned and learning to say the words, my ability to enunciate, I used to have a horrible stutter, a stutter that would stop me sometimes from breathing. And so to come to the place where I can do interviews or I can be a public speaker, this is all a product of listening to Chuck D and following the lyrics that Public Enemy published and listening to KRS-One. KRS-One speaks through my mouth every single day, especially when I'm teaching class. And so that ability to get with young people, get with adults, and learn how to think more carefully about their world. I often teach a group called Black Star. Now it's Yasin Bey and Talib Ali. And they have a track called Thieves in the Night that is just a classic. My students all memorize it. And it's about finding courage and seeing hope in your world and not falling victim to the predatory influences that can surround you. And so to learn the lyrics in that song, it literally is adapting a Toni Morrison lyric from The Bluest Eye. And so you have to ground yourself in literature, in history, in science. You have to change the way you go about educating yourself just to get through the experience of listening attentively to that song. And so the critical engagement, the way that we grow through the way that we share our music, it's a unique gift. I won't even call it a weapon, but it's something that once you awaken it in people, they can never go back to sleep.
Mm-hmm. Where is your book available?
Everywhere. Go on there. Amazon, but especially Universal Right Press. You want to go to the main publisher site and get it from there. That's the direct, easiest, best way to get it. But yeah, your Barnes & Noble, your local favorite Black-owned bookstore, they can all get hold of it.
Okay. The book, once again, Illmatic Consequences, The Clap Back to Opponents of Critical Race Theory. There it is, right there. Yep. Put the cover up on Facebook. If you go to Education at the Crossroads, you can see it there. You can get it. And one of the things we will endeavor to do as we move into the fall and winter is approach the publisher so we can get some books to offer as premiums to our WBAI listeners. You know, we can go ahead and do that. We can work that out. So I guess we will. I'd like to say, Asante Sana, thank you very much to our editors, Professors Walter Grayson and Professor Damian Darrell Jerry, the editors of this book, which is substantial and important and impressive. All right.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for taking the time to be with me. Listen, folks, this is it. We'll be back next week. I'll be around at least another week. One announcement, I guess, for people who like the community in the Bronx, Mind Builders Creative Arts Center, this Saturday, the 16th, is having its annual Open House Street Festival. You need to go check it out. There'll be young people performing all different kinds of ways. There'll be a talent show. There'll be a lot of different things going on. There'll be vendors right on Olinville Avenue in the Bronx, a couple of blocks away from the number 2 stop, Gun Hill Road. The address is 3415 Olinville Avenue. It's going to be on Saturday from about 1 p.m. until 6. Come check it out. You will enjoy it. It is, of course, free. Check it out. For further information, you can call tomorrow, 718-652-6256, 718-652-6256. Also, don't forget to vote in the WBAI-LSB election. If you've gotten a ballot, send it in. If you haven't gotten a ballot and you're eligible to vote, make some noise so you can go ahead and get a ballot and vote. It's important if we want to keep this station alive. And also, of course, donate to WBAI. Go to the website, give, G-I-V-E, the number two, WBAI.org. You've been listening to Education at the Crossroads. My name is Basir Mchawi. We'll be back next week. Peace.
Contacted, I attract clientele. My mic check is life or death, breathing a sniper's breath. I exhale the yellow smoke up the roof through righteous steps, deep like the shining, sparkle like a diamond sneaker. He's moving on the Allen and my army jacket lining, hit the earth like a comet invasion. Nazis like the Afrocentric Asian, half man, half amazing. Cause in my physical, I can't express through song. Delete stress like Motrin, then extend strong. I drink my wet with Medusa, give a gosh stuns in hell from the that I lived in hell. It ain't hard to tell.
The next WBAI Advisory Board meeting will be held on Sunday, September 17th at 1 p.m. The meeting will be held by teleconference. The call number is 619-309-1058, and the PIN number is 641-711. Everyone is welcome to call in and join the meeting. Once again, the call-in number is 619-309-1058, and the PIN number is 641-711. It's a way to show support for this great station. Thank you.
WBAI's election balloting period has started, and you can vote through September 30th, 11:59 p.m. Look out for a link to your e-ballot in the form of an email from invitations@mail.electionbuddy.com with the subject line, Vote Now, Pacifica Foundation, Inc., 2023 Local Station Elections. You may also receive a text message with a link to your e-ballot. If you need to request a new ballot, file a ballot request form by visiting elections.pacifica.org. If you do not have access to the internet, please leave a voicemail on 213-635-9363. Please only file one request, as multiple requests will slow down the processing time. It's 99.5 FM WBAI in New York and online at WBAI.org.
Politics is moving to Friday. This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette and the host of Max Politics here on WBAI Radio 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Our show is moving from Wednesdays to Fridays at 5 p.m., so check me out then with guests including elected officials, advocates, candidates for office, experts on a wide variety of policy and political issues, and more. We're going in-depth with newsmakers, analysts, and other great guests every Friday starting in August at 5 p.m. here on WBAI.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say that over and over, and there was no escape.
WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
WBAI accepts snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it. We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing.